Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. In the spring of 1676, Nathaniel Bacon, a hot-headed young newcomer to Virginia, led a revolt against the most powerful colony in the New World. Known as Bacon's Rebellion, this uprising turned into a civil war within Virginia, and a war of extermination against the colony's Indian allies. The events of 1676 sent shockwaves throughout the British colonies, and into the heart of England itself. On this episode, we're discussing Bacon's Rebellion. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. In Season 1 of the series, we're discussing the frontier of colonial America, the places and events that defined it, and the people and ideas that changed its history forever. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. In today's episode, we're discussing one of the most confusing and controversial episodes in American history, but one that is absolutely defining in understanding how the frontier of the American colonies altered the direction and the identity of the New World forever. We're discussing Bacon's Rebellion in this episode, and we're doing it for two very distinct reasons. Number one, it gives us a great opportunity to revisit the American colonies and how the frontiers and their relationships with those frontiers define their growth and formation. And number two, it also allows us to explore how historians approach a particular topic and how, even though the facts are all the same, and the information is totally present, you can have completely different interpretations of the same events. So it's a useful topic for us in a number of reasons. We'll begin by reviewing the events of 1676, Bacon's Rebellion, a rebellion that would bring the North American colony's most powerful colony to its knees. And then we'll talk about how, as historians, we interpret those events. And we'll try to draw a logical conclusion to a very big and very difficult topic. Let's begin. 1676 is a pivotal year for the American colonies, particularly the colony of Virginia. At this point, the American colonial experience for Britain is just taking hold, and the English roots are just beginning to be firmly planted in the New World. By this point, tobacco has been realized as a profitable cash crop. In fact, it's a cash crop that you can easily make a fortune out of. And because of its geographic locations, its climate, and its economic system, the colony of Virginia is very clearly distinguishing itself as the tobacco kingpin of the New World. When we view 1676, we're seeing a Jamestown and Virginia colony that's existed for the better part now of 7 decades, 70 years of roughly, that this system's been in place. And what that means is the first generation of founders are long gone. And even that second generation of people, those people first born in the New World, are on their way out. So we're seeing Virginia in a state where the traditions and the origins and the privileges of having perhaps first dibs at a colony are really becoming evident at this time. Now, to understand where Bacon's Rebellion comes from, we need to understand a little bit more about the economic workings of Virginia. But here's what we can say. To this point, the standard form of labor has always been indentured servitude. If you think about traveling from Europe to America, or America to Europe here in the 21st century, you'll see that your largest cost is almost always travel. There's no cheap way, whether it be 400 years ago or today, to cross the Atlantic Ocean. And that is true in 1676 as well. Typically, a plantation owner would seek out indentured servitude for their labor. That is, they would pay a person's passage through the Atlantic Ocean, something that very few people could afford on their own. And the way they would pay off their debt is by working their land for a period of 7 or 8 years. That's indentured servitude. And when you're finished with your duties, when your debts are paid off, you're given a small parcel of land, not large enough to be consequential, but much larger than anything you'd ever have in the old world, and you could start your life, begin your American dream again. And what you're seeing in 1676 is that Virginia's beginning to go through a state of flux. And that state of flux is for this reason. Tobacco is extraordinarily profitable to this point in the New World. You can set almost any price you want. You can sell it almost as soon as you pick it, maybe even before the harvest. And it is a surefire ticket to becoming extraordinarily wealthy. Now, it's a difficult plant to grow, and because it absolutely requires regular rotation of crops, you need a great deal of land to produce it. So tobacco is a commodity really only produced in enough quantities to become super wealthy by a small handful of very privileged peoples. Well, what's occurring is, after about 50 to 60 years, is that one and two and three generations of indentured servants are becoming emancipated. They're becoming free of their debt. And they are also engaging in this tobacco harvest and enjoying the fruits of their labor. But here's the problem. With so much tobacco being produced now in Virginia, the prices, because there's a surplus developing, something that never existed before, are beginning to drop incredibly fast. So the landed elite, the landed aristocracy of Virginia, begin to look very closely at their system of economic governance. The idea of the indentured servant is going quickly by the wayside, because as the surplus grows, the price of tobacco drops, and that's money out of their pockets. So by 1676, African slavery really is becoming a la mode at the time. It's something that gives you all of the work of an indentured servant. It is probably more expensive at the outset, but it pays for itself over and over again throughout time. Plus, you never have to emancipate these people and give them that guaranteed parcel of land that they joined the agreement in for in the first place. So Virginia in 1676 is a place of conflict. And that conflict is brought on for a number of different reasons. Bacon's Rebellion, as we'll see, is a big part of this conflict. So let's get to how the aristocrats, the upper classes, begin to handle their tobacco problem. We have to understand who these people are, who's in power to really get it. And the person we'll start with is the colonial governor. The colonial governor of Virginia is named William Berkeley. And Berkeley has been governor now for about 35 years. He is deeply associated with power and prestige and wealth in Virginia. He is a tobacco grower. He has an enormous tobacco plantation, and he does very well for himself. You have to understand, in Virginia, tobacco is directly associated with success. The way we think of cars and airplanes and homes as being indicators of success is how the average Virginian would view a tobacco grower. A tobacco grower needs to be successful, needs to be wealthy to have a profitable crop. So those two values go one and the same, and Berkeley really exemplifies that. He is an old favorite of the king from his early days as governor, and his face is really associated with that old guard in Virginia, those early landed elites that made so much wealth and developed so much of a colonial fortune from the earliest days of the colony. Well, he will have a young man jump into his life named Nathaniel Bacon. And Nathaniel Bacon is not typical of your average colonist. Now, Nathaniel Bacon's father lives in England, and he believes that young Nathaniel has a lot of growing up to do. He's a wealthy man. He's a powerful man. He has opportunities that the average person wouldn't have. So he sends Nathaniel Bacon to Virginia, hoping the notion of roughing it in some way, which may have been a stretch, would help him develop and mature into a successful man of the 17th century. Well, Nathaniel Bacon is young and ambitious and hungry, and he wants money, and he wants all of the accoutrement that goes along with it. Nathaniel Bacon will very quickly marry into the family of William Berkeley, the governor. And what we see is a major and drastic change in the dynamic that we're going to explore, because Nathaniel Bacon is given a seat and given a large parcel of land, courtesy of the governor, his now in-law, his relative through marriage. And this will put the two on sort of a collision course, and we'll see a lot of the conflicts and a lot of the divides that exist in colonial America, in every colony, really focusing on Virginia, begin to emerge. We're going to begin in 1676, in all places on the frontier of the British world. Now, frontiers are amazing places because by their very existence, they bring together cultures that have no shared history and no shared identity, but through considerable interaction, you'll begin to see that they develop and they form that identity, but typically at the expense of a great deal of heartache and a great deal of bloodshed. Well, the same is true of the Potomac River region of Virginia in 1676. There's a farmer who owns a small plantation along the Potomac River who will be raided by a party of Doeg Indians in 1676. And this is nothing uncommon, but this is very much an indicator of something much bigger at play. Now, the original incursion by the Doeg will really arouse the populace of the region. And these are not wealthy people, but these are largely former indentured servants just trying to carve out a place in this colony, hoping to get a small taste of what men like Bacon and Berkeley had, for all intents and purposes, given to them. The response will be terrifying, because the people of Virginia in that region will rally together and retaliate against the native peoples they believed instigated the attack. But the problem is, they attack the wrong peoples. They attack a group of people who had nothing to do with the original raid, called the Susquehannocks. And this is a very big problem if you're the governor, because what you have is an angry mob of people marching, claiming to have some political authority, certainly the authority to kill. And as is usually the case, a rabble is typically not well disciplined, and the wrong native peoples were killed as a result. So Berkeley will jump in very quickly, and he's very out of place here, because he represents a population that doesn't reflect or is not indicative of the people that retaliated in response. These are the lower classes. Berkeley represents the upper classes. And Berkeley's trying to tell these people, restrain yourselves. We will sort this out. Now, for the average population, they're in a world economically that's changing. Everything's changing. Their system is changing. African slavery is moving in, and their system, the indentured system of servitude, is moving out. So for them, opportunities and avenues for opportunities are being lost forever. And here comes the governor telling them how they should live his life. Well, we can imagine how the frustrations of that economic time can manifest itself. We can imagine what they're saying. It's the us versus them. It's the upper class versus the lower class. But it's also a sense of Berkeley trades with the Indians on a regular basis. The colony makes a great deal of money off of that trade, and Berkeley's trying to protect them. Now, that wasn't the case. He was very likely trying to keep the peace, but from the minds of the militia, from the minds of the average people engaged in the attack against the native groups, it seemed like Berkeley was pushing them aside and showing his true allegiance early on in alliance with the Indians. It's in this internal struggle between the Virginians themselves that we see the real crux of the rebellion starting to rear its ugly head. Because Berkeley, the governor, is viewed as an enemy. He's viewed as an outsider. But if a political figure already in power could harness that groundswell of populist support, that mean streak of the average man fighting back, he could become very popular himself. And that's where we see the young Nathaniel Bacon really enter for the first time. If Berkeley is attempting to maintain peace and maintain order, Bacon, on the other side, is trying to do quite the opposite, because he comes from the pre-existing internal power structure. So all of the things that make him powerful, his family, his wealth, his ability to plant and grow successfully, all makes those lower classes look to him as a natural leader. And he takes their anxieties, and he takes their fears, and he takes their frustrations being vented against the native peoples and against the governor, and uses them to his own advantage. This is a very old political tactic. It's something used throughout the history of the Western world and still used today. Get this groundswell of angry, desperate people to support you, and they will skyrocket you to new heights in the political world. And that's the standoff we see. Bacon versus Berkeley, both of them from that large power structure in Virginia in the New World, but each of them with their own interpretations and their own values at play. Now, we have to be very careful how we talk about this event, because it's a confusing one. You see a lot of players, and you see what appears to be a lot of causes. In history, we love the old cause and effect formula, but it doesn't necessarily always play out in the way we're used to, and certainly not the way we're comfortable to. The effect is always there, but there can be, and most often are, multiple causes. And if there's one problem with Bacon's rebellion, it's that we try to use the one cause, one effect formula far too much. Bacon's rebellion is a window into the time period, but it reveals the many layers and many conflicts that divide the colonial American world in the 17th century. Now, if you were Berkeley, you seek a diplomatic solution. It's the natural course for a man who's benefited from the old system of the old world. And he brings together a number of native chiefs and a number of representatives, including Bacon, from these lower class, angry, frustrated militants that saw the brunt of the Indian violence and the frontier violence in the first place. And of course, what happens? Well, it turns into a disaster. Many of the native chiefs are killed by these Virginians, and Bacon, all the while, is very much agitating the situation while Berkeley's trying to calm it down. He has to preserve good relationships with friendly native peoples. Indian trade is a critical element of the New World economy. But he also has to show his own colonists that he will not stand for any violations of their rights as Englishmen. In March of 1676, Berkeley will devise a new policy, because right now, his colony's divided. Many people are saying, in the upper classes, Berkeley's doing the right things, trying to maintain or discover a peace between these people. Many in the lower classes, though, side with Bacon, because they say that Bacon really believes in us, and Bacon supports us. This is politics at its finest. So here's what we'll see. In March of 1676, in the House of Burgesses, it'll be decided in an agenda largely promoted by the Governor Berkeley himself that good Indians are considered allies and, quote, bad Indians will pay for what they've done. And Berkeley goes about this in the completely wrong way. What he decides to do is effectively fortify the frontier. That is, put a physical divide between what he deems to be English territory and what he deems to be Indian territory. Now, by its very nature, the frontier is fluid. It's always changing. It's always growing, and it's always shrinking. And in many ways, the frontier itself is always just that small line where those two cultures come together and form their own unique identity. And you can't fortify that. You can't quantify that. You don't know when you're in it or out of it, but you certainly can see it when you're there. Berkeley will decide he will not send troops to attack. He will not instigate war, but he'll build forts. And that's a very big issue because, one, forts are incredibly expensive, and the way you pay for them is by raising revenue. Revenue increases. So the taxes are raised on the people of Virginia. And of course, the people paying the most for those taxes are the people who would stand to benefit most from the forts, the lower classes along the Potomac River and the other frontier regions of Virginia. Berkeley doesn't view it as a problem. He sees it as being revenue neutral. That is, all of the tax money raised will go simply to fortifying the frontier. But the colonists don't see it that way. They see it as, we have legitimate grievances about being protected from these Indians, hostile or otherwise, and the solution is to raise our taxes. Now, it doesn't help that the forts are built in completely inefficient places, places that simply do not provide the desired effect that Berkeley wants. Again, you can't quantify the frontier, you can't build a fence, but that's what Berkeley tries to do. And inevitably, it's a tremendous drain on public funds, and it's largely completely ineffective. So again, battle lines are drawn on a number of different fronts here in Virginia in 1676. But they're about to become much more severe, because part of Berkeley's new policy of building those forts and defining a clear frontier meant that people who were trading outside the bounds of those frontiers would be hurt considerably as a result. Nathaniel Bacon, interestingly enough, was one of those peoples. So he would go to the population of anxiety-filled lower classes, and he would begin to say, all of us benefit in some way from Indian trade, him of course more than most, but Berkeley's laws are clearly done to favor his persuasion. And he was correct. Berkeley's friends had a great deal to say in where the frontier was defined, and as a result, his friends gained the most from pushing out some of the lower classes that lived further away from Jamestown, further away from the heart of culture and society in Virginia. Well, Bacon will promise to a group of about 300 Indian fighters that he will not only defend their rights, but, I think perhaps most importantly, pay for any campaign that they would take on against the native peoples. So he's elected a general of sorts, of a ragtag militia of Virginians. And he goes on a campaign against the native peoples outside of the authority and outside of the scope of the governor himself. So with his band of Indian fighters, Bacon will make his first official move on the field of battle against a small native group known as the Pamunkey people. And he'll attack the Pamunkeys to push them off of their land, ostensibly extending the frontier into areas that would benefit he as an Englishman. Well, at this point, the governor will make his first effort to squash Bacon's banditos in Virginia. And he'll send about 200 of his own men after Bacon. Now, Bacon will escape with his militia, with his army. But Berkeley makes it very clear through official colonial policy where he stands with Bacon. He will declare Bacon a rebel. But he'll also, very importantly, declare that if Bacon's men renounce their allegiance to him, they'll be given a full pardon by the colony. So again, Berkeley is trying to resolve this in a way as peaceful as possible. He also promises Bacon a fair trial, but that does nothing to bring the rebel leader from within Berkeley's inner circle itself out into the open. Bacon will continue with his militia to assault native tribes, and his next target will be the Oconeechee Indians along the Roanoke River. This is roughly the border between Virginia and North Carolina today. So this is the worst case scenario, at least he thinks, to Berkeley. Things are clearly, at best, out of his control. And he's got to rein in the population, because they have a leader, and this movement has a face, and it's someone that he's tied intimately to, Nathaniel Bacon.
Now, this is not an unusual circumstance, particularly in the 18th century, because one of the things that we find in most rebellions is that even though it appears to be a rebellion of the lower classes, you often find that a pivotal member of the existing power structure, someone who stands to benefit in a different way than the people rebelling, will be front and center in a movement such as this. And that person is Nathaniel Bacon. If you are the governor at this point, it's 1676. Your colony, which is the richest, most profitable colony in North America, seems to be slipping from your grasp. And Berkeley will take the initiative to not only put the blame on himself, but give the colony of Virginia a chance to right this wrong itself. And he'll do it in this way. He'll declare new elections for the Virginia House of Burgesses, and he'll even put his own name on the line to the king. And the idea is, if the king blames him for the revolution or the rebellion, he can remove him. Now remember, Berkeley's been in power for 35 years. He's a very rich man. He stands to lose a great deal from this, but he also hopes that, as many people still submit their resignations today, his sense of duty and honor before self will be recognized, and he'll keep his position. Well, interestingly enough, when Bacon is declared officially in rebellion by the governor, he will be, of all things, elected as a new member of the House of Burgesses in the elections that Berkeley hoped undid a lot of the stress to begin with. And he's still a wanted fugitive. Imagine that. In Henrico County, in Virginia, he is elected as their representative. So clearly, there is a place where Bacon's version of rule, alternative to Berkeley's, is still very popular. And that's a very troubling thing if you are the governor at the time. Bacon will arrive in Jamestown in June. And when he attempts to take his seat in the legislature, he will be arrested. He's still a wanted man. But Berkeley understands that to deny this man his seat and to deny this man his power will not serve to do anything but further agitate the rebels. So he gives him a position again on the assembly, and things begin to very shortly calm down. But that's only the beginning, because soon after, the issue of Indian violence arises once again, and a Bacon-aligned member of the legislature will nominate him to lead the rebellion, to lead the forces, that is, against the Indian uprising. This was the entire issue to begin with, and Berkeley cannot have this happen. What emerges is a large disagreement and a collapse in power structure. Bacon will flee the capital, and he'll bring back 500 men in support of him. There will be a dramatic scene in Jamestown. Berkeley will expose his chest to Bacon and basically say, shoot me here and shoot me now if that's what you want to do. It becomes a very dangerous and very difficult scene. And also at this time, for the first time, members of the Virginia House of Burgesses begin to buckle under the prospect of a rebellious uprising. Because of these recent events, Bacon will be voted on by the legislature as the commander of forces against Indians on the frontier. And this begins a very difficult power struggle in Virginia. Berkeley will make pronouncements to his people and to the empire. Bacon will do the same. Until eventually, on July 30th, the entire system breaks down. The governor, Berkeley, sensing that Bacon has a groundswell of support, will abandon his position and flee to the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay. Bacon and his army will approach the town, and they will create a new alternative assembly with Bacon as their leader. What began to many as an Indian war has now become a civil war within rebellion, and the population of the colony will be forced to choose sides. This is not an unusual scene for us as historians, but it's a very unusual one in colonial America, because for the first time, the crown's grip, so to speak, over the colonies are beginning to unravel. What you have is a dual power base in the New World. On the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay, you've got the original colonial government of Virginia, the one endorsed by the king, Berkeley and his followers. Yet on the western shore, and keep in mind, the colony of Virginia really only extends less than 100 miles east or west from the Chesapeake Bay, is under the control of Bacon. And for all of June, July, and August, Bacon and his rebel army will continue their pursuit of any Indian groups they deem to be hostile. Now, it seems like Bacon is taking his eye off the ball here. Why spend all of your time pursuing friendly and enemy Indian groups when you should be governing the colony? But it gets to the crux of Bacon's power. Bacon is only in power because he has the support of the underclasses, and what the underclasses care about is not Berkeley, is not tobacco prices, but it is Indian violence, protection from Indians on the frontier, and the capturing of Indian lands. So Bacon is really torn between two different vices. He does want power, he does want prestige, he wants everything Berkeley had, but the only way he can keep it is to appeal to the masses, and that means fruitless and empty efforts to capture and kill Indians on the frontier. It's not very successful at the time. The native peoples are very adept at the situation. They know how to avoid Bacon's rabble, but he does kill many native peoples in the process. He's trying to appease his people, and in that same way, he always has to serve two masters. Now, during the same time period, Bacon doesn't completely take his eye off the proverbial ball, because he will use a great deal of his followers to pursue and locate Berkeley and the other royalists, I suppose you could say, on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay. He'll send out naval warships in search of the governor in exile. And here's what we actually begin to see. Berkeley's very astute at what's going on. He sees Bacon's vessels approaching, and while they believe they're hunting him, he's actually using his pre-existing authority to lay a trap for them. He will capture these members of Bacon's rebels, and he will hang them as a result. Men like William Carver and four other associates of Bacon's will be killed on September 3rd and September 6th of 1676. So you do have a colony in full-scale rebellion. And although the others don't know it, both sides, in their own minds, are being successful. Bacon is keeping his people in line by keeping them satisfied. Berkeley, in his mind, is capturing a number of high-value targets from within Bacon's association itself. In September of that year, Berkeley will feel very emboldened, and he will begin to make a play at re-entering Jamestown on the western shore. And this will seal the fate of that early outpost of empire. In September of that year, Bacon will come into the city, and he will declare that the city should be, quote, level with the ground. Bacon and his followers burn all state buildings in Jamestown, and therefore most of the city. Warehouses, taverns, state houses, even the church. Berkeley and those loyal to him will be again refugees, and you have the most powerful colony in the New World on the brink of total disaster 100 years before the American Revolution is even a twinkle in the eyes of the American colonists. Now, this is the most amazingly revealing part of the story for us, because we can often think of history as preordained. Looking back, using the benefit of hindsight, we feel that we have a control over the situation. But never forget, these are human beings. These are people as susceptible to all worldly vices and worldly occurrences as we are today. In October of 1676, with the capital city of Virginia burned to the ground, Jamestown destroyed, Bacon holds all the cards, but he can't control Mother Nature. He will contract dysentery, as many of his fellow colonists did, and pass away on October 26, 1676. The rebellion never recovers from Bacon's death, and this is not unusual. They were held together by his ability, by his charisma, and most importantly, by his connections and understanding of the larger English political system. He gave a voice. He gave a method to the perception of life that these rebellious colonists sought. And he was taken from them, not from a stray bullet, not from swinging from the gallows, but by Mother Nature. It's an amazing story. But Bacon's rebellion will effectively lose its steam at that point in 1676. We mustn't forget, this is not the end of anything. This is a rebellion that will go on for several more months. But Bacon, the glue that holds the rebellion together, their mechanism of potential success, the one that takes a rabble of people, often motivated for different reasons at different times, and brings them together as one cohesive force. This is the number one reason that rebellions of this nature don't succeed, because they're often driven by different factors, bringing different factions of people to operate as one. But that cohesive bond cannot stay without a figure like Bacon. Bacon dies. Now, at the same time, as a testament to the poor level of communication in the 17th century world, back in England, King Charles II is taking action. He will send 1,000 men to Virginia to calm this down. And of course, they have to cross that Atlantic Ocean. When they arrive, you see the real heat of the battle emerge. You see a large amount of fighting. But in the end, by January of 1677, Berkeley begins to tighten his grasp on the situation. Once power and once order is restored, Berkeley, again, only an extension of the crown, not a political leader in his own right, that ideal really hasn't emerged yet, will set sail for England to speak with the king himself and give his account of the events. He gets there by June of 1677. He will die in July of that same year without ever having a chance to explain his understanding and the reasons for his decisions of that rebellion that same year. Mother Nature is a cruel mistress, and she cares nothing for the power of politics. So why are we discussing Bacon's rebellion in the context of the American frontier? Well, it's an important event for a number of reasons. One, because it's very telling and very revealing. And two, because it's so often misunderstood. We always say in this podcast, history is not about finding something new, but it's about looking at something old in a new way. And Bacon's Rebellion gives us a wonderful chance to look at this very chaotic and very confusing series of events with the benefit of hindsight and historical training, and trying to extract and extrapolate and pull out all of the meaning and all of the potential interpretations that we can. Many people will say this is, in some fashion, a precursor to the American Revolution 100 years earlier. And that seems to be an easy statement, because you have rebellion against royal authority, and you have Americans fighting English soldiers at this time. But that is a very misleading interpretation, and one, quite frankly, that does not reflect almost anything we see in the historical record. Yes, you had Americans fighting Englishmen. And yes, you had colonists fighting regulars from England against royal authority. But motivation is so much of this story, we can't discredit it, we can't discount it. These people were not fighting the system that the English represented, that Berkeley represented. They weren't trying to overthrow it for a new system. They were simply upset that they were not being included to the fullest extent within that system. So I suppose the simple way of saying it was that they weren't so much against the theory of the system. They were not battling the ideology of the system. They're battling the fact that they felt like the deck was stacked against them and they couldn't benefit in it in the same way. They weren't trying to overthrow slavery. They weren't trying to eliminate the king's grasp. They weren't trying to eliminate the fortunes of the planter aristocracy. They were simply trying to take it, and they wanted to be included in it. So this is not a precursor to the American Revolution in that way, but it is, upon further inspection, a very revealing indicator of a lot of the issues that in 100 years, in 1776, will drive that same style of thinking. So what is the issue at hand? Well, most will say that the issue is a matter of not rich versus poor, not haves versus have-nots, but those with opportunity against those without it. Remember, the promise of the New World, the reason you upend yourself from your English world, your way of life, the way of life of your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, was because the New World offered you something you could never have in Europe if you were a member of the lower classes, and that was opportunity. You uproot everything to engage in that with that promise, and in Virginia, in 1676, what we see is the same old story. Those with power, those with wealth, retain it, just like they had in Europe here in the New World. And those without it often don't receive what they believe to be the fulfillment of the promise of America. We set the stage early on in this episode with the economic changes going on in Virginia. The idea that you become an indentured servant so that upon your freedom, when you work off your debt, you can become one of these planter elites, one of these wealthy and powerful members of the colonial world. But we also saw that there were distinct measures taken in the Virginia legislature to make sure, and you could say through artificial government intervention, that that system did not produce the effects it was intended to. Remember, too many people were producing tobacco. Tobacco, for a very long time, was the crop of the very wealthy, but there was an overproduction of it. There was a surplus of it, and the very wealthy and powerful would lose their way of life as a result. So we have to be clear, one of the most divisive issues, if not the most divisive issues in the colonial world, was not the rich versus the poor, or the haves versus the have-nots. But it was the fact that opportunity and the promise of opportunity was not shared by all. So in a way, it was those with a chance and those who never have a chance. That's what drives Bacon's Rebellion. You could interpret it as perhaps an Indian war that drives the Civil War. That's a critical part of it. But it's only just that, a part of it. Bacon's Rebellion shows that life on the frontier, the people taking the risks of expanding your imperial worldview, can be very troubling whenever the promise of opportunity isn't delivered as well. Bacon's Rebellion is one of the most fascinating topics in all of colonial American history, not just a Virginia phenomenon, but one that is very revealing for the colonial system as a whole. But it's also very confusing, and it's very unsatisfying. There's a lot of historical events that'll wrap it up with a neat bow at the end for you, and make it clear and present. That's why we're studying this. But Bacon's Rebellion
is not one of those topics, but that's what makes it so worthwhile.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.